The deadline for a new farm bill is the end of September. Can farmers expect political action before the election? From SDPB, today is Tuesday, August 20th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, U.S. Senator John Thune says the politics of an election year will most likely delay movement on the next farm bill. We'll talk about that and about why Thune is seeking the top leadership role for Republicans in the Senate. Teachers prepare for back to school. We'll discuss emotional regulation in the classroom and how teachers contemplate talking about politics at work. We also get to know poet John Nelson with a look inside his latest collections. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
Healthcare reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Breastfeeding offers many benefits to mom and baby, but I'm not going to lie to you, it can be hard. I know this from experience. It can be really tough getting started. Fortunately, there are a lot of breastfeeding resources here in South Dakota. Emily Brooks is a lactation consultant at Sanford Health, and she is seated across the table from me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We were talking before we turned the microphones on, and I was telling you my story, which I remember so clearly after 23 years of parenting.
Yes.
So for people who are going into having a new baby, bringing home a new baby, and wanting to breastfeed, how should you prepare yourself?
Great question. So there's so much to know about breastfeeding. One of our favorite services out at our Sanford Children's Child Services in town on 57th and Western is a prenatal breastfeeding class that parents can take. Okay. It's a free class they sign up for, an hour-long class, and we just talk about the basics. So how to succeed, how to build a good milk supply, how to hold your baby, how to latch your baby, few things they might encounter, some struggles along the way, and kind of how to cope with that.
Yeah. The benefits. Why do you want to get invested in this ahead of time?
Yes, absolutely. Just talking to them about how wonderful their breast milk is for their baby and just all those nutrients and antibodies in it that'll help keep their babies healthy and give them so much growth and good things. So yeah, we talk about those little benefits with them. Cool, fun facts with them about breastfeeding to make them really kind of intrigued about why they should do this.
Yeah. Coming in and learning some facts.
Yes.
Also about where your resources are going to be.
Yes.
Is important as well. To know that it's not necessarily going to be swathed in, you know, pink and blue fuzzy blankets while you quietly breastfeed your child and the world is just at peace. Sometimes it can be a struggle for people.
Absolutely.
What are some of the main obstacles and struggles that parents have?
Yeah, so in the first little, even just 24 hours, just sleepy babies, baby figuring it out for the first time, mom figuring it out for the first time, making sure that it's going right. Sore nipples is a huge one that people deal with if maybe baby's not latched quite right. And then having some pain with breastfeeding that maybe they didn't expect or makes it a little tough to want to continue.
And this is something that we don't often talk about on the radio. So let's talk about it. It hurt.
Yeah.
I was in pain. I was in physical pain.
Yeah.
And then all the books would say it's not supposed to hurt.
Yes.
And so then I would say, well, I'm doing it wrong then because it does hurt.
Yeah.
And so how do you, when a mother comes to you and says that to you, how do you, how do you approach that? How do you help her?
Yeah. So just kind of validating what they're going through, first of all, and then just offering them that support of, let's try to fix that latch or let's reposition baby or see how baby is nursing to try to get it more comfortable for them or trying different techniques, teaching them how to take care of their nipples to get those healed, or maybe pumping for a little bit to give their nipples some rest if they need it. So
one of my favorite things about this process, again, I'm bringing myself into the story, but I think we don't often talk about that much, people's personal stories, was people like you, the number of other medical providers and other women who had experience who just surround, which is awkward at first, yeah. right? Like, yeah. it's super awkward at first. You're like, okay, everybody's looking at me.
Yes.
But then the number of women who came and said, we got you. We're going to help you get yeah. through this.
Yep.
Talk about emotional support for
yes,
women nursing.
Absolutely. Yeah. yeah. So the great thing we have, I feel like everyone on our team is fantastic of just meeting moms where they're at and being them there for them and kind of being their cheerleaders to get them along and make this easier for them. But then we also have free services at that 57th and Western location where moms can come in, get their babies weighed before and after they're done feeding, get any help. And what's great is in the morning, that's an open house community. So there's other moms there as well that people can bond and hear each other's stories and kind of feed off of each other and relate and give that support to each other too. So that's a huge thing for those moms yeah. just to feel reassured and normalized and they can relate to those other moms as well.
The weighing of the infant before and after feeding, because it can be hard to tell whether
yes.
your baby ate.
Yes.
It's a lot easier in a bottle to see how much
yes.
they took.
Yep.
How much do they need to be consuming in those early days?
Yeah, so it kind of varies baby to baby, but really in the first couple days, they're just consuming small amounts, teaspoons. So mm-hmm. their bellies are just small. They hold about 3 to 5 milliliters. So they're just getting small, tiny amounts, but that colostrum just really packs a good punch with it in there and just really fills their belly for them.
Yeah. How long yeah. are people breastfeeding now? What is ideal?
Yeah.
What should we be thinking about when we make those decisions about our lives and going back to work and childcare?
Yeah.
What are some of the challenges and opportunities there?
Absolutely. So kind of standard for American Academy of Pediatrics is exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months. And then kind of as long as desired as mom and babies would like. I feel like we see a lot of people in the Midwest kind of aim for that first year of life, especially when they go back to work, pumping, getting that breast milk provided for babies that are going in daycare, especially right. flu season. So we are happy to help moms even going back to work, kind of create a pumping schedule, help answer their questions, their fears about keeping that milk supply when they go back to work
yeah.
and maybe challenges they might face too.
Yeah. Not for everyone.
Yeah.
My big benefit was I was not organized. I did not like doing dishes. And so I did not want any bottles.
Yes.
I didn't want anything that I had to measure or fill. I couldn't afford formula. And so it became very affordable for me too. And
yeah.
my financial situation at the time, that helped as well.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
It can be for some people.
Yeah.
Also a really convenient, affordable way.
Yes.
To feed your kid in those first days.
Absolutely.
All right. So a lot of people listening from outside of the region of this, you know, stop in clinic. So check your local communities. Ask for
yes.
help.
Yep.
Go online. Look for some of those online yeah. resources. Get the information you need to know.
Yeah, we have a phone number that people can contact as well, a lactation support line.
Okay.
So even if people aren't local, they can always give us a call and we can hopefully try to direct them in the right area.
All right, we're going to leave it there for now. Emily Brooks, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
We're going to very quickly transition to U.S. Senator John Thune because he stopped by the STPB studios this morning. We talked about the Farm Bill and Senate leadership roles. Here's our conversation. U.S. Senator John Thune, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori.
Current Farm Bill
yes.
expires in September, and everybody mm-hmm. wants to know what will happen next. Do you think we'll have something signed by then? A delay? What's your projection at this point?
I think that'll be a big question tomorrow at Dakota Fest. We do our annual farm forum over there in Mitchell. I think, unfortunately, it looks to me like we're running up against the deadline without a replacement in place, meaning that we'll probably end up with another extension. Now, where the extension goes until after the election, into next year, or it's a full year, I think that to be determined, although I would expect more than likely it'd be a full year.
Yeah.
Just extend the current bill, which we're already on a one-year extension of the current bill. So it's unfortunate, but that's where we are, and I think on the calendar we just don't have enough time. The House has passed out of the Ag Committee over there a farm bill, but they haven't moved it across the floor of the House yet. We still haven't had a markup in the Ag Committee, Senate Ag Committee, so we're way behind in terms of the time that would be necessary for us to get this done.
I don't follow Senator Stabenow's work very much because she's a Democrat from Michigan, so I don't have a lot of reason to look at her press releases, but I did in preparation for today, and she is really talking about how important it is not to split the coalition mm-hmm. between hunger advocates and farmers and conservationists. Senator Rounds, when he was here, talked about her wanting to pass something as part of her legacy. What's your relationship with her, and do you agree with some of those fundamental points of it don't split the coalition, it's based on this bipartisanship, or do you think that things need to be divided up a little bit more in order to have success for farmers?
I think that probably, and I've worked with her in the past on farm bills. This is my, now will be my fifth farm bill that we've worked on, and I served with her on the Senate Finance Committee, too, so we've partnered up on some healthcare things in the past. But I think there's just a big difference of opinion right now about how to allocate resources and how to prioritize within the bill. What you hear John Bozeman saying, who's the senior Republican on the Senate Ag Committee, is we need more farm in the farm bill. And I think that the coalition you've talked about has survived previous farm bills because it gives people on the East and West Coast who don't have a lot of production agriculture a reason to vote for a farm bill. So they vote for the nutrition title in the bill. Mm-hmm. The nutrition title in the bill is about 80% of the spending. And the commodity title, which is if you consider crop insurance and then the other safety net programs, ends up being about 10%, and conservation roughly 5%, and then other odds and ends, other titles of the bill. There are 12 titles in the bill. Constitute the other 5%. But, a huge percentage of it is nutrition. I think the dispute right now has to do with whether or not some of the $20 billion that was set aside in the Inflation Reduction Act under conservation could be used in the conservation title of the farm bill, or perhaps even reallocated to the commodity title of the farm bill. And she's been resistive to doing that, and partly because I think the priority for those dollars is climate-related activities or spending. And so right now there's just a big difference of opinion about where the money ought to go. And, obviously here in South Dakota, we care a lot about Title I, the commodity title of the bill. That's the agricultural risk coverage program, the ARC program, the price loss coverage program, crop insurance, and those sorts of things. So I hope that eventually we can get there. If it doesn't happen now, next year, depending on who wins the majority in the Senate, if we have the majority, John Bozeman from Arkansas would be the chair. Amy Klobuchar from next door in Minnesota would be the ranking Democrat in that scenario. And I would be hopeful that we could get a multi-year reauthorization bill done. But we have to find some of those additional revenues. And, like I said, the disagreement right now really is over the where to put the money within the bill. Historically, the disputes have been regional. You know, the South has rice and peanuts and cotton, and we have corn and wheat and soybeans. And Michigan and California have specialty crops, fruits, and those sorts of things. And we've always been able to bridge that gap. So there have been differences between regions on how to prioritize among the commodities, and we've always worked in that because the theory's always been either we're all going to hang together, we're going to hang separately, and I think that's still true, and that's why the nutrition title has not been split off, notwithstanding pressure in the past to say, why don't we deal with the nutrition title separately? It's a different part. It shouldn't be in this farm bill, but you probably would have a really hard time passing a farm bill without it, honestly, because it's what brings people from the coast to the bill.
So help people understand the difference between the political reality of what the work that's on the table that needs to be done before an election and the idea that there is a stalling, which would be, maybe not helpful to farmers because we're looking at how power may or may not shift after the election. That's a fine line that I think it's worth hearing your thoughts on. What's the difference between, like, hey, this is the political reality and the time that it takes, and, oh, by the way, if we take our foot off the gas a little bit, we might get more of what we want, which people would criticize.
Yeah, and I think there are substantive differences that are real and legitimate. I mean, I do think this is an election season. There's no way around it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just, it's a reality that you deal with. And we're seeing it play out on across the board. It's not just the farm bill. The defense authorization bill, which is probably the most consequential bill we do every year, has been available now for several months. Came out of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Senator Schumer has opted not to put it on the floor, notwithstanding the fact that we've had multiple weeks where it was available and ready to go. And that too, I think, has to do with not wanting to cast difficult votes on amendments going into an election. So I think there's a certain amount of election year politics that shapes the agenda. And honestly, I say this regretfully, but I don't think there's going to be much done between now and the election, because in September, when we get back, we've got three legislative weeks, one of which will be a shortened week because of the Jewish holiday, and we have to fund the government, which I assume will be some sort of continuing resolution that takes us until after the election when we deal with all the big issues. And then he's indicated the possibility of having a crypto bill on the floor. I'll be shocked if that happens. I think, you know, for all intents and purposes, the Senate at least, and for that matter, I would think the House too, is kind of shut down until we get through the elections, and then we'll see how that shapes the agenda after the election. But again, not my preference. We got a farm bill to do. We got a defense bill to do. National security is a huge priority for the country. We've got a number of pieces of legislation that have been reported out of the Senate Commerce Committee that would be available for the floor, one dealing with artificial intelligence. So I'm a big believer that we ought to be using the time that we have here to get things done that need to be done. But I also am a realist, you know. I mean, we're in an election season, and in the Senate, at least, we don't control the agenda. The Democrats do. They've had the majority for the last 4 years. So anything that comes up on the floor is going to be decided by the Democrat leader, Chuck Schumer. And at this point, it doesn't look like that's going to be much.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because Senator Mitch McConnell is stepping away from his leadership role. I'm sure you're aware there's a lot of buzz in South Dakota that you are the person who very well could take on the leadership of your party in the Senate. Give us a little behind the scenes to where is that something you think about or are talking about? Like, how does that work for people who don't understand the mechanics of it? And then also, what kind of leadership would you bring to that? Were that your role after the election?
Well, I think that to answer the first question, the way that it works is after the November election, after every November election, every 2 years, the Congress, the House, and the Senate hold leadership elections. So Senator McConnell's announced he's not going to run for Republican leader. So that position will be vacant after this election. And I've announced that I am seeking that. There are others who are as well. And it's a campaign. I mean, you've got to persuade your colleagues that you're the right person for the job. There are currently 49 Republican senators. We hope after this election there'll be a few more. If we get some new ones, they would be able to vote in that election as well. So it's trying to make a persuasive argument about, you know, why you're the right person to lead Republicans in the future. And with regard to your second question about leadership style, I mean, Senator McConnell and I have different, very, very different leadership styles. His has worked really well for him, and he leaves big shoes to fill. He's done this for 18 years, which is now makes him the longest serving Senate leader in history. But, you know, transitions like this are pivot points. They're an opportunity to kind of usher in that next generation of leadership, and I hope I represent that. We'll find out come November.
Yeah. Why are you the right person to lead?
Well, I think that we're going to be facing some really tough issues and challenging times, and I think, you know, the ability to bring people together, I've always believed that leadership is about making the people around you better. And helping your team succeed. You know, clearly, no matter who wins, the majority will be a fairly close one, as it has been, which requires, not only ability to try and unify your side, but hopefully to reach out and get some Democrats as part of the coalition. You know, to do most things in the Senate takes some level of bipartisanship. And I think the Senate historically has been that check and balance in our democracy, because of the supermajority requirement to get things done. It's designed to protect the rights of the minority. And I feel like I've got the hopefully Midwest common sense character qualities that would enable us to govern under what are some arguably difficult circumstances and some hard challenges. We're going to have to do some hard things, and it's going to require an ability to try and, you know, pull people together.
Yeah, the U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled, and I'm going to lose the name of the actual ruling here as I try to remember it, but basically the laws that you passed are going to be very important in how they're executed, because you can't rely on those executive branch federal agencies to, you know, default to their decision-making. How does that ruling change the way that you need to pass laws? Because up until now, sometimes you've intentionally left things up to some of those federal agencies to, you know, the scientists at those federal agencies will determine how this is implemented. And that's been part of the process. And now the Supreme Court has said, you know, that's going to go, you know, that tipping point is going to be on the judiciary, which puts pressure on Congress to really be clear in their lawmaking. Does that question make sense? You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah,
there?
No, it is. Okay. It was the Loper decision, came out in June, but it rolled back a 1984 case. It was referred to as Chevron deference, and it would be where, there would be deference given to an executive agency or department that took a law passed by Congress and then interpreted broadly. And so this rolled that back significantly. So, yeah, to your point, it puts more pressure on Congress to be clear and concise, to make sure there's clarity. And when you codify things, that you are being as detailed and specific as possible. But I think it points to a larger issue, which has been around for a while now in our government, and that is that this tension that exists between the Article 1 and Article 2 branches of our government, between the legislative and the executive branches, has sort of gotten out of whack and out of balance. And there's a perception, at least, both political parties, Republican and Democrat, when they've had the White House, have pushed the edge of the envelope in terms of executive power and executive reach, to a point where many would argue that it's overreach. And so I think that what that court decision does is it points to Congress and says, okay, you're the legislative branch of the government. We're going to defer to you, but if you aren't going to make good decisions, it's going to end up in the Article III branch, which is the judiciary, because they're not going to allow the executive branch to sort of run roughshod, if you will, or use a broad interpretation of the statute like they have in the past. A lot of this, I think, is going to end up being litigated, which does put pressure back on Congress
to do its job. On the other hand, that's where all the experts are. And you rely on those experts in those federal agencies, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, there's a certain amount of that, and it's a balance. I mean, it always is. But I do think that it's going to force us to reexamine the sort of checks and balances that the founders wanted and created, and how those operate in a framework that is, very different and way more modern. A context is very different from what they, what they were dealing with at the time they wrote the Constitution.
Which takes real leadership.
Well, it does.
And bipartisanship.
And right. And I think, again, an understanding that in order for us to get things done in this country and to put up a record of accomplished for the American people, that we're going to have to figure out how to work together.
Right.
And obviously in this polarized environment, that's really challenging.
Yeah. U.S. Senator John Thune, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks, Lori. Good to be with you.
We'll take a break. Teacher Talk is up next on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We have been getting ready to go back to school with the Teacher Talk educators. SDPB's Teacher Talk is our weekly education spotlight where Jackie Wilbur and Gina Benz gather around the table to explore the highs and lows of teaching. You can also download it as a podcast for all the installments in one place. Well, this week we hear more from our guest teacher, Gabe Dannenbring. He's a middle school science teacher in Sioux Falls. He's also a social media influencer who has garnered more than 2 million followers for his relatable and humorous content. Now, teaching can be emotional work, and emotional regulation is an important part of becoming an effective teacher. So we will start this week's conversation with a heavy topic, grief and loss when it enters the classroom. And then we'll get into politics, because teaching, you might have noticed, intersects with politics in important ways. Before we get to that, here is a little bit about our Teacher Talk teachers. Gina Benz is in her 25th year of teaching. She's a recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award. She leads teacher pathway classes and teaches at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member at the University of South Dakota. She's director of the Center for Student and Professional Services in the School of Education. She's been a teacher, a librarian, and she's also a yoga instructor. We'll begin here with Gina Benz talking about some of the difficult aspects of the classroom.
We had two teachers die this year in my school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And One of them, Glenn Toll, was the most amazing social studies teacher, former military as well. So teaching was his second career. And when I had to read the statement, the prepared statement to my students, I couldn't get through it. One of my students said, I can finish it for you. And he finished the statement for me. I left the room. And there were principals. We have several principals. And one happened to be there. And I just said, I need you to go in and tell these students why I can't continue. And he went in and he took over the class for me while I composed myself. Now, this is a rare thing, but sure. We're a team. And the team means the student who helped me, the principal who helped me. Yeah. We did it together.
Mm. Jackie, we talk about this all the time, that relatability, but with the authority, the vulnerability, but also I'm still in charge of the classroom. Mm-hmm. These are things that you get to show up and be yourself, but yet you're still a teacher. Maybe that's easy for teachers in the sense because you're teachers. Or is there a challenge? Are you trying to figure out where that line is of, you know, when do I laugh? Humor would be even an easier way to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Something happens in the class that's really, really funny, but probably not appropriate. Mm-hmm. Where is that line between acknowledging, like, yeah, that is really funny, and now we're not ever doing that again.
Right, yeah. Right. Oh, I have several moments in my head that were just like that, and I would be laughing, and I would say, I am not laughing right now. But I think being emotionally regulated is the best way to simply say what we're talking about, right?
I'm hoping that wasn't the answer.
But there are times where if your personal life is stressful, on top of school life being stressful, it's hard to maintain that emotional regulation, and then it's much more difficult to deal with dysregulated middle school, high school, elementary school students who are experiencing their own range of emotions and are not regulated because it's not developmentally appropriate or possible at some stages. And so I think keeping in mind that you're the adult and therefore you have to, and I think what we're all talking about here in emotions is saying they are valid, they teach you things, we all have them, and as you grow older, you learn to emotionally regulate and have appropriate responses. And to have a colleague who you care about so deeply pass away isn't a time to say, I need a minute. And so to be able to do that in a way that everyone was still taken care of, everyone had what they needed, including you, is so valid. And I think you also demonstrate this on the other end of the spectrum, Gabe, with your videos to say, like, here's all the hurtful things middle schoolers said about my outfit today. And I was like, wow, I've heard so many of those things. And so I felt seen and heard. And also you weren't like screaming about how terrible middle school kids are because they made fun of your outfit. That would be emotionally dysregulated. You were laughing and recognizing that they were going to probably be doing that for a while. Mm-hmm. So.
It's their love language. Middle school love language is showing, is making fun of adults because they don't know how else to show it. But one of the best leadership moments I saw this year is very similar to your story, Gina, where we had a staff member pass away at our school, and we also had a former student pass away. Mm-hmm. And we had the meeting in the morning of going over, hey, here's what happened. Here's the script. Here's what for you to read. And our principals at my school are just so good. I can't speak highly enough about them. And our head principal, he said, listen, it's okay to get emotional today. And he said, I recommend you show emotion because the students need to see that you are people, and that's what's going to help build this community. And I was like, yeah, that he's so right. And I think as a teaching profession, we are really starting to make a turn in a good way of going from these robot teachers that we once were. You have to fit into this exact box to, no, we're people. We have emotions. We feel a certain type of way. Now, you have to maintain that professionality with it, absolutely, but you can still be a person. And I think of Saturday Night Live, where some of the funniest moments on Saturday Night Live is when Jimmy Fallon breaks. He breaks character. Yeah. He laughs. That's great every so often, but if these people on SNL always broke, it would feel messy. If they always broke character, it'd feel messy. So as teachers, we're in that same boat where a kid might say something, you're like, I shouldn't laugh. I'm trying to keep the smile down. And then you kind of go along with that, and you break character, and it gets that joyous feeling of community in the classroom. But if you do it too much, it becomes messy, and it's starting to lack professionality.
Yeah,
perfect. That's a good analog.
I want to go back to something you said about talking about politics.
Yeah.
And we've been talking about this, too, is, yeah. you know, when do you advocate? And I think I asked this question of Jackie Wilbur maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it especially relates to you, because when you have that kind of platform, people say, if something comes up in education that is political, you know, you're making money off of this. It is your job to respond to it. And if you are silent, you might get deplatformed. Yeah. If you say the wrong thing, you might lose followers or take heightened criticism. So where, and we, she answered this, and I think you answered it, but what is your answer to the obligation of maybe speaking out about something, oh gosh, everything, because now everybody is turning on to see what you said about the latest education political thing that might not be the world you want to be in. How do you navigate
yeah,
that?
Yeah, and it's such a good question, and it's so hard to, it's a hard question to answer, and it's something I've really thought a lot about, is what is my duty? Is it my duty to, for every single piece of legislature, for every single state that gets passed, I should say something, or should I not go that route? So I think a lot of people, no matter what industry you are in, they want people to speak up about different situations, especially things in politics. But it gets really tricky when you say something that they might disagree with. So people want people to speak up and say, please, you know, talk about this subject, talk about this. And then I might say something and people might disagree with it. Well, then it's, well, don't talk anymore. Don't talk. Actually, we don't want you to say
go back
that.
To the classroom.
Yeah, go just stick to teaching. Stick to,
stick to the textbook.
It's like the shut up and dribble, you know, like that old analogy of if you say something that people might not like, then people are going to start saying, we don't care about what you have to say anymore. We don't really care. So for me, it's really hard because my platform is built off of community and entertainment and making light of what our profession is. So do I now make a turn and make it way more serious and talk about those things? There's some things that I think all teachers would agree on, different political issues. One of the things is like school shootings. There's not a single teacher in America that thinks that we're going down the right path when it comes to school security and school shooting. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not a good thing. It's easy to speak up about that and say, we need a change. It's easy to get support for that. Where it becomes really challenging is, what if I speak up and say, hey, maybe these charter schools, maybe they're doing something right. Maybe there's pieces that we can pull from this and bring it into public education. Well, then people start saying, I don't know about that one. Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing about teachers is we are such a diverse group of people. Teachers are so diverse. Mm-hmm. If you look at a high school, you have a PE teacher and an AP English teacher that have the same job. Those people probably have completely different life experiences. They might look at life completely different. So this idea of teachers all look at things the same way, we all have the same political beliefs, is so not true. So not true, to my point of when I went on Fox News. I just talked about a topic that I think most teachers probably agreed with, and I had people calling me a Nazi, and other people said that they love me. So there's no way of making everybody happy. I pick my battles. I pick my battles, because the other thing is, I'm as a public school teacher, if a parent would see me speaking up about something that they might disagree with, they can go to my school and make it a headache for my principals. Mm-hmm. And that might be a cop-out of an answer for me saying that's why I don't get too political on my channels. But I don't know. There's just so many things to unpack. So I definitely do sometimes talk about those situations, but other times I choose to keep my mouth closed because I don't want to cause more divisiveness in the education community.
Yeah. Again, that modeling that we talked about before. Yeah, I like to say make it easier for your editor to defend you.
Yeah.
If you're in journalism, don't make your editor work too hard to stand up for you.
And there are some amazing teacher creators where their brand is talking about the politics. Mm-hmm. That's their thing. Awesome. Yeah. Good. If that's what you want to do, go for it. That's not my complete brand. I like talking about education policy. I like talking about issues we have in education and talking about how we can fix it. I don't want to create divisiveness within our own community.
Mm-hmm. Middle school is my favorite, by the way. If I were to be a teacher, I would teach middle school.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was my favorite time as a parent. It was my favorite time as a parent volunteer. It would definitely be where I'd want to go.
What do you like about it, about middle school age?
Oh, it's just so delightfully, creatively unhinged.
You know, that's a good way,
which is, I mean, you never know what's going to come out of their mouths. They're exciting. They're fun. You know, they're right at that cusp of figuring out who they want to be. They're not scared. It, you know, but yet they're becoming scared. It's just, it's wonderful. They're becoming who they are.
Yeah. Some of them look like high schoolers. Some look like they're fourth graders. Yeah. It's such a weird hodgepodge, but you can't help but love them.
And you know, honestly, great. I think the real answer to that question is, and I loved all my daughter's teachers, but those middle school teachers, they're the ones that I wanted to be like. So that's probably more of a reality for me as a parent. It was those teachers where I was like, man, I want to be like you someday, because they had
Can I say one more thing? I know you're trying to wrap, and you're probably like, don't say one more thing. I'm gonna ask a question. So to your question of what is my duty as somebody with a big platform to speak up on those things? What is my duty? Like from people outside looking in, what is the answer? What do you want me to do as a voice for education? Would you want me to talk more about it? Would you not want me to? Are there times that you say, dang it, Gabe, this is now your time to speak up and you're choosing not to?
I really liked your answer. I think you do need to pick your battles, and we need to remember, and you said this, that we're teaching students in a classroom, and these students are really diverse, and we have to, if we get too polarized, divisive, then that might affect the learning environment. So we do have to be very careful about what battles we're going to choose. I also think you're already doing a great service, because you're giving people a glimpse into what school is like nowadays. It's very easy to picture school like it was for you when you were sitting in that desk. When I was sitting in Lenox High School in the 1990s, that's not what high school looks like anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it is, what you do is good to give people a realistic view of what it looks like today.
Mm-hmm. Jackie, how would you answer that question for Gabe?
Yeah, I mean,
and be brutally honest, you won't hurt my feelings. I got thick skin.
Well, you'd have to do what you're doing, which I also really admire about you. I think that it's almost inappropriate for me to tell you how to do you. And I think that's what you're doing, is to show up authentically as yourself in the way that you are. And that is what's inspiring to other people, to say, oh, there's this person being themselves. That empowers me to do the same thing. And so for me to say, do it this way, would then now become inauthentic. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think your real message is, that I see you putting out there. Mm-hmm. So
I need you to take care of yourself.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, well played.
So are you saying some content that is about?
No.
No.
I need you to take care of you, because in my worldview, someone who, and I'm from South Dakota, says, I think this is a, you know, very South Dakota middle-aged lady thing to say. When you get this level of success, I want to make sure you're okay. Mm. Because I see you giving and giving and giving. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when are you off? When are you, what if you wanted to take a break? How would you take that break? How are you taking, what does your self-care look like? Because that's a lot of attention that is on you. Mm-hmm. And I want to take care of you, and I want to make sure you're taking care of yourself.
Yeah. That's I'm still finding the right answer to truly take care of myself.
Like, I think to clarify, I don't want to enjoy something as much as I enjoy your work, and then find out it was harmful to you.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point.
No, well, I think, and teachers are in that same boat too. Like, you gotta take care of yourself.
Yeah.
We're givers naturally as teachers. We're givers, and we're emotional creatures, and we're caring, and we've got so much enthusiasm. But that is a huge energy suck. And it gets really hard for teachers to actually say, I got to take a sick day and go take care of myself, because we feel guilt all the time as a teacher.
Yeah, something I had to do this year was, during my planning period, I had to lock my classroom door and shut off the lights. Mm. Mm-hmm. Because people would come in asking for advice, or a student come in asking for help. And there are certain times set aside for me to help them, but I needed a little bit of alone time, because I am a more introverted person by nature. And so that recharged me when I could turn off the lights and lock the door. And then I was a better teacher because of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What questions do you have for Gabe about the behind the scenes? You know, how this thing works. I feel like my listeners are going to be like, you didn't ask him about this. You didn't ask him about that. This is what
what we tuned in for.
You're thinking, I couldn't ask him any questions, and he kept rambling and going on and on.
Yeah. He asked all these high-level questions, but what I really want to know is what shoes brand he wears.
What I think a lot of teachers want to know is, how did you establish this whole social media presence with your school district? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, they didn't shut you down.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the things that I really think about in every decision that I make, and my father-in-law told me this. He said, can you look the somebody in their eyes and defend your actions? Mm-hmm. So I think about that a lot with my videos. If I made a video that was not good, it was offensive, it was inappropriate, whatever, you know, whatever box it checks, could I look my principal in the eyes and defend my actions? Mm-hmm. I think about that a lot. All my videos, I can look my principal in the eyes and say, I can defend why I did this. I think what I'm doing is a good thing for our profession. And I think the district plays that game with me too. They understand that, hey, this is all a net positive. It's hard to make it only be 100% positive. There's going to be some things that they probably look at and say, maybe you shouldn't have done this. Maybe you shouldn't have done that. But it hasn't been a huge glaring thing that has been like, all right, now you flew too close to the sun and we're going to shut this thing down because it's a bad look for us. I want nothing more but to make the Sioux Falls School District look amazing. Mm-hmm. I want people to watch my videos and say, that's a district that I want to work for. Yeah. And the district has been very good to me. They haven't shot me the email and said, all right, you're done. We're done doing this, which is awesome. And I, if it does ever get to that point, I do want to show them the thousands of messages and comments, tens of thousands of people saying, thank you for doing this. You know, this has inspired me to be a teacher, or me and my son or daughter, we watch your videos and laugh. That is a great way to help build more of a community and more of a cohesion between teachers, families, and their kid. As teachers, we know right now there's a lot of people that might not like us and think that we're here indoctrinating the kids and doing all this crazy stuff. That's not what we're here to do. And I think the district sees that what I'm doing is a net positive. And,
I agree.
Yeah.
You can find Teacher Talk as a podcast on your favorite podcast platform. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Poetry isn't hard to find on the prairie. Bootjack was published by Pask Press. That's the publishing arm of the South Dakota State Poetry Society. It's a collection of 70 poems that span nearly the entirety of South Dakota poet John S. Nelson's career. Now, Nelson is a retired professor of English for New Media at Dakota State University in Madison. A native of Fort Pierre, South Dakota, he writes about work, travel, and other human and celestial activities. And he's with me now in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio. John, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laurie. It's great to be here.
I am such a fan of your public readings as you travel with the Poetry Society and do open mic nights and performances. I'm always Poetry on the Road. I'm always excited when you take the microphone.
Thank you very much. I really enjoy it. And so to hear that other people do too, that's a wonderful thing.
And so what a delight to have a collection.
Yeah.
Now, Pask Press, tell us a little bit about the publishing arm of the Poetry Society and the direction it's going, because this is one of the out-of-the-gate collections.
Yeah. This is the second book from Pask Press. We had a collection from another poet, and this is the second one from Pask Press, and we hope to publish more. Our editor is Christine Stewart, who was the South Dakota Poet Laureate prior to her departing for Canada.
Yeah.
And
took a job north of the border.
Yeah.
But still very connected in South Dakota poetry.
Very much so. Yeah. And she was instrumental in helping me put this together and shape it in the way that it is.
Yeah.
So
help us understand what that process was like for you, looking through, you know, decades of poetry and finding gems and finding things you maybe forgot you had written or things you wanted to rewrite?
Yeah. As maybe some people know, some of these poems were published in the 80s.
Wow.
And so in small magazines. And so I submitted the manuscript. I put together a collection of poems. For a while, had them all these pages laid out in my porch, trying to decide on the order and what went in and what didn't. And I sent that off, put it all together and sent it off, and was accepted as one of the first books to be published by Pask Press.
Will you read for us something from the collection?
Yeah. So I joke that on the readings that I have these old man poems. I'm now 67. Surprise, surprise. And you just kind of notice some things as an older person now. And this is a poem called Gesture. When the soda bottle fell from my hand and rolled under the car, so I had to kneel and reach in the shadows, a much younger man strolling toward the store said he'd get it for me. A kindly gesture I waved away with my back hand, as though age itself had crept up knowing to look beneath the bumper and find me reaching for what I had lost.
I like the series of old man poems because they're for all of us, right? Why does poetry from South Dakota by South Dakotans matter?
Well, it matters everywhere. And so South Dakota is a unique experience, just like it is in any other state. And we have to add our voice to the many voices that are in the United States and across the world. Our voice belongs there. And so it's good to have it.
And you have spent a lifetime of noticing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And noticing where you're at, where you're from, who you're with.
Yeah.
How do you capture an idea and then move it toward
That really the page? Is a tricky thing. You know, a lot of times what will happen is that you'll see something or something will occur to you, and then you have to find the language that captures that and provide the language that does it. Because a poem is about language. And this kind of efficient, challenging way to get at some idea or some vision that you have that's different than simply saying, like, I just drove back from the Black Hills yesterday, and as I was driving along, I saw somebody on a motorcycle, two people on a motorcycle, and the guy in front, his hair was blowing around, and there's a woman right behind him. And so her view of South Dakota is populated by that hair of her partner on the front of the motorcycle.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you see something like that, and it's this kind of, to get at the poem, which I haven't written, you have to find some kind of language or some perspective in which to try to capture the weirdness of that inhabiting that woman's perspective as she's
and
writing.
And it might take months for you to find the language for it, or it might take a couple hours and it appears to you. And all right, so we're going to have you back because we've had such a short period of time with you today, but the book is available now in bookstore, independent bookstores across the state of South Dakota.
Yep.
It is called Boot Jack, and you can always go on Pask Petals and the South Dakota State Poetry Society website and find those collections as well. Yep. John Nelson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Lori.
We appreciate your time.
Glad to be here.
That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On the next In the Moment, we will sit down with South Dakota Estate Auditor Rich Satgast. We'll talk about the mechanics of how taxpayer dollars are spent in light of recent financial misdeeds by state employees. From all of us at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.